You're listening to the Stephen Wolfram Podcast, an exploration of thoughts and ideas from the founder and CEO of Wolfram Research, creator of Mathematica, and Wolfram Alpha. Coming up, the second episode in a three-part series exploring the future of AI and civilization, recorded live at the Wolfram Summer School at Bentley University. In the second installment, Stephen talks about the future of digitized humanity as a box of a trillion souls computing and simulating reality, and how AI can be thought of as an alien intelligence. Let's have a listen.
In any case, that's kind of the other direction is, okay, so you have this digital reproduction of what brains do, what the relationship is between the actual person and the digital reproduction of the brain is an interesting question. Not obvious what the how one should think about that. Not obvious how one should think about kind of the backup process for the human and so on. But in any case, you can, but imagine that you can have something which is either at a biological level or more interestingly perhaps at a purely digital level, sort of a representation of the consciousness of the brain, so to speak. And you know, one thing that's then difficult is to realize that the experience of, you know, the brain in the digital box is a little different than the experience of the brain in the, this, you know, biped that's walking around with, you know, eyes at a certain height off the ground and so on. And so it's actually, you know, when it comes to asking, so what does the what does the brain in a box think is the point of everything? That can be very different and bizarrely different from what the you know, what the actual brain embedded in human thinks is the point of things. And for example, the very, you know, existence of mortality and so on makes a difference in what people think the point of things is and so on. So anyway, the sort of what one starts to think about is, okay, so imagine that we've got a successful kind of uploaded consciousness situation where, you know, my version of this is the box of a trillion souls. So you take, you know, take the souls of all humans, so to speak, and you basically represent them digitally, and you've got this box, and this box represents kind of the future of the consciousness of our civilization, right? So then what? So, you know, one of the things that is kind of upsetting at some level is we can ask the question, you know, what's special about this box? You know, this box is the whole future of our civilization in some sense. And yet, if we look at this box from the outside, what we'll see in the box is a lot of physical processes going on of, you know, electrons moving from here to there and little, you know, little things happening and all that kind of thing. And we'll ask ourselves, what is the difference between this box and a rock, for example, which also has all kinds of electrons doing all kinds of things and so on? What is the, you know, how do we distinguish this box that is the proudest, grandest future of our civilization from the rock? And the answer is, it's tough, I think. I mean, this is kind of the lesson of the principle of computational equivalence, is that it's not that the things that are going on, the computations that are going on in our sort of box of a trillion souls, we're more sophisticated than what's happening in this rock. That isn't going to be a criterion. The criterion has to be the computations going on in this box of a trillion souls are the things which to us seem like they're the most significant things one can imagine because they are the carriers of the future of our history. Yet the things that are going on in the rock are just things that are going on in a rock. Just like, you know, we see the weather we can say sort of has a mind of its own. That's kind of one of the kind of the everyday versions of the principle of computational equivalence. But yet, you know, while it may have a mind of its own and be doing all kinds of different things, we don't have an understanding. We don't have any kind of cultural resonance with the way that the, you know, that Nimbus clouds operate and things like this. So that's, and so I think this question of sort of the future of civilization is this kind of box of a trillion souls. How do we think about this? What is, and the you know, this is significant to us because it is the carrier of the future of our history, but, you know, then the question is, well, how does that evolve? And how does, for example, how do purposes that humans find for things evolve in that situation? Because I was mentioning kind of the, you know, the evolution of technology, the evolution of our civilization is partly a story of the evolution of purposes that we find for things we want to do. And so the question is, you know, when it's a bunch of uploaded consciousnesses in a digital box, how does human purpose, what happens to human purpose? And difficult problem. I mean, you can go, you know, you can read the theology literature on the subject, you know, in models of kind of, you know, souls in heaven, so to speak. What do they choose to do? Not particularly profound kind of insight from that I've seen, at least from from kind of the theological direction. I mean, it's kind of like it's sort of the notion is, well, people like hanging out with other people. People like doing art and music and harps and all that kind of thing. I don't think it gets that far. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think there's yet a profound insight on what one can expect. But it's sort of in a sense, that's the place, you know, that's one of the fundamental things we have to understand is what is the, you know, in a situation where there's no scarcity and where there are none of the drivers of mortality and things like this, what are, you know, how do human purposes evolve? I have to say I was very depressed about this whole question a little while ago, because I think the basic conclusion is in this model of the future of civilization, it's basically the future of civilization is disembodied souls playing video games for the rest of eternity. And that's, which is kind of, which to us today seems pretty lame. And worse than that, looked at from the outside, there's nothing special about this box. It's like we could also say inside a rock, there are kind of virtualized souls, not ones that we understand, but conceptually virtualized souls effectively playing video games for the rest of eternity. And so that's kind of a lame view of the future of history. And I was kind of thinking, gosh, that's pretty bad. And so then I started thinking, well, how do we think about the kind of the meta idea of human purpose? And so one sort of thought experiment is go back 1,000 years, find somebody from 1,000 years ago and show them modern times and say, do you understand why people are doing what they're doing today? And the answer will be, no, there are tons of things where we just don't have a clue why people are doing the things they're doing. I mean, they just look completely pointless. Like, good example is, you know, walking on a treadmill. Why do people do that? Explain that to the, you know, knight in shining armor, so to speak, from the Middle Ages. It's like, well, we're doing that because we think it improves our health so that we can live longer, so we can do this. And it's like, no, you know, the point of life is to, you know, die an honorable death type thing. You know, you don't understand. So it is complicated. I mean, the evolution of purposes in human history has been an evolution in purpose. It's not the case that the purposes we thought of 1,000 years ago are the same as the purposes we have today. And I think it is probably the case that at any given time, you know, what to us may look like, I mean, to me today, I see, you know, kids playing video games. I say, what on earth is the point of this? And yet to them, there is a, you know, there is a perception of purpose, so to speak. And it's not really clear, there is no absolute purpose that one can identify for anything, I think. And so the fact that, you know, it is meaningful to the kids playing the video games, that's sort of enough. And if we look at the future of sort of the human condition, the fact that there can be, you know, it's a bunch of disembodied souls in a box doing what appear to be, to us today, playing video games for the rest of eternity, it can still be perfectly meaningful to those souls, you know, 1,000,000 years from now, doing what they're doing. Now, one thing for me personally that's sort of an amusing thing to think about is, okay, so first of all, you play video games, so to speak, about the actual universe, right? So one thing you can do is you say, well, let's, you know, I'm embedded in this box, but still, like in the Matrix, I can sort of simulate what's happening in the outside world, what would happen in the real life universe. But then, you know, that could get kind of boring because the universe is just you get to work out all these different things in the universe. So, okay, forget the actual universe. Let's just go out into the computational universe of all possible universes. That's much more fun. We can go explore all of those. And so that kind of vision of the future of humanity ends up being, you know, maybe the future of humanity is the disembodied souls exploring all the possible corners of the computational universe of all possible universes, which put in other terms is, the future of humanity is mostly people studying NKS, basically, which is that's a reason why it's kind of a funny conclusion to come to that might be what happens. It's certainly a funny conclusion for me to come to. But I think so this question of what's the future of, how do purposes evolve and so on, this relates to another really, to me, important issue, which is, when have we discovered everything that we might ever discover? When have we, you know, is there a limit to, so we know, you know, like in mathematics, we can just enumerate an infinite number of possible theorems. But the question is, you know, when do we stop finding interesting theorems? Similarly, in invention, we can enumerate an infinite number of possible inventions. In physics, even if we have the fundamental theory of physics, so long as there's computational irreducibility, we can enumerate an infinite number of possible questions and start answering them. But we might say, well, we've run out of interesting questions after a while. Okay? And so that's one of the ways in which it seems like playing video games for the rest of eternity seems boring, is because it seems to us like we might just run out of interesting questions. It's like somebody might say, as people did 100 and something years ago, you know, all the interesting inventions have now been made. There's nothing more that's interesting to invent, which turned out to be wrong. So what one realizes is there's this question of will there always be new interesting things to discover? Or will there come a time when, for example, an area of mathematics, like say number theory, where all the interesting facts of number theory have been found? Okay, so we conclude there's an infinite number of possible facts of number theory, but the question is, will the interesting ones all have been found? So then the question is, well, what's an interesting fact? And that's something which turns out to be pretty difficult to define. It's something that is very societally defined. If we ask, what's an interesting feature of the world, we actually have a way of representing interesting features of the world, which is the words we use in human language. So if we say, something is repetitive, we say that's a feature of the world that we've identified as being something that is worth commenting on, so to speak, and so we have a word for it. There might be some other feature of the world that maybe even one of our AIs would notice, but we haven't chosen to think it's interesting enough that we have a word for it and that we can kind of, something to in our kind of culture and language and so on. So this question of a model for interestingness, an example of interestingness is what do we choose to give words to in our language? Another one would be what theorems did we bother to publish in the literature of mathematics? These are all sort of examples of interestingness. What inventions were worth making, and so on. So but this question of interestingness is closely related to questions of purpose and things like this. What things are purposeful to do? When we look at this sort of ocean of possible computational systems, which ones are interesting enough to identify? You know, I looked at in the NKS book, I looked at things like, if you look at all possible chemicals of certain kinds, which ones are interesting enough that they are in the chemical databases, as opposed to just being, well, you could synthesize that, but nobody cares, right? So what one starts realizing as one thinks about this kind of notion of interestingness is that I think there are stepping stones that sort of the civilization provides a series of stepping stones of interestingness, so to speak. So what we see, for example, in development of computer languages, we see increasing levels of abstraction. If, for example, I know from Wolfram Language there are constructs that we have today which, had we introduced them 30 years ago, we pretty much could guarantee nobody would have understood them, including us, probably. But over time, there's sort of an ambient understanding of things. These stepping stones have been created and have been sort of cemented in the civilization, and then you can go on and get to the next level in terms of what you can define and consider interesting. And so I think that's what you realize is that there's this kind of notion of interestingness that has this progressive nature to it. So for example, one of the things I've been curious about in mathematics, you know, to what extent is mathematics an arbitrary construct that's just sort of the consequences of, you know, the arithmetic and geometry that was studied in ancient Babylon? And to what extent is it then just, okay, we happen to pick on these things, now we're just picking off sort of random theorems that are possible given those things? I think, and is it the case that the history of mathematics, for example, is a pure historical accident? Or are there, in a sense, is there some kind of other stepping stones that put you in a particular direction, and then you kind of have inexorable progress because you're going through those stepping stones? Same kind of question you can ask about the history of biological life and evolution there, that there are many things it could be the case that we could be inventing things today that are kind of independently invented and do not make use of the kind of long path of history. To what extent are the things that are discovered by biological evolution or in mathematics inexorable and inevitable, and to what extent are they just accidents of history? And I think increasingly I'm sort of realizing that there's this kind of hierarchy, there's this path of interesting things that you have to go down. So to get to the next level of abstraction, to get to the next sort of step in this hierarchy, you have to go through, you have to sort of go on one of these stepping stones. And there's a certain path dependence. Once you've got some of these stepping stones, you're going to have more stepping stones that go only from the position of the last stepping stone you got to. Don't go back to the beginning again and go from there. So I think there's sort of a concept of sort of this kind of progression of interestingness, which I think in a sense is a representation, is an idealized representation of kind of the progress of civilization in a sense, is that we've in the progress of knowledge, human knowledge and so on, is this kind of sequence of steps that that we've taken. And so one thing I've gotten curious about is whether there is a way of representing. So I think a critical question in terms of sort of the future of what humanity is like, so to speak, is this question of how do human purposes evolve? How does what's interesting to humans evolve? Is there a meta theory of how that evolves? Or do we just have to say, well, it's a historical accident? You know, there might have been social media at this time, there might not have been. It's just a historical accident, or is there some inexorability to what happens? I don't really know quite how to think about this, but I sort of have the analogy now. If you were thinking about computation before the idea of universal computation, there were all these different notions of what, you know, there were all sort of idealizations of computation that one might imagine. The question is there some sort of analogy between that and this kind of notion of what counts as interestingness is there kind of a meta theory of interestingness that one can define? So that's kind of a thing I'm curious about. Is there a way of just as we've taken in computation and universal computation and the idea of Turing machines, things like that, we've taken what were the concrete manifestations of particular examples of computation and found some idealized model that can sort of capture a wide swath of computations and then discover that there's this universality principle that makes them all equivalent. So similarly, is there some kind of thing where we think about sort of the hierarchy of concepts that meaningfully exist, and can we kind of make some similar kind of meta theory of those kinds of things? Now maybe we'll see some practical examples of this in neural nets. You know, you can take, you know, do neural nets form concepts? Well, they kind of do at some level. Can we think about the ways that neural nets form concepts, and can we see what happens if we take a neural net that sort of formed a set of symbolic concepts and use those symbolic concepts as the encoder for another neural net? Does that give us something which is kind of a different level of amplification than we've seen before? And that might be a sort of meta model for what we're talking about with kind of this evolution of interesting things. I mean, I think one example of this in mathematics, there's the question of when you do an automated proof of something, it's often very hard to understand that automated proof. But the question is, are there kind of human understandable waypoints, human understandable lemmas on the way to this proof? And when there are, it's like it's good, it's like a proof that you might read in a journal. When there aren't, it's just like this sort of disembodied kind of series of steps that don't have any sort of resonance. They don't have a story that humans can tell themselves about how that might work. And so I think that's the that's kind of the thing that sort of realizing is that if you do an automated proof and you say there can't be any lemmas, it takes exponentially longer typically to do a given proof, or actually worse than exponentially longer, because you keep on having to go back and reprove all those things which you could have said, oh, I've got a lemma, I can just use that lemma and keep going from there. And I think that's sort of the same thing as whether you have a concept that has been formed or whether you're always going back to basics again and reforming that concept. And so I suspect there might be a thing that similarly in neural nets, there might be a thing of, can you make something? You know, the encoder of a neural net is always a kind of a flaky thing that isn't quite the same as the neural net itself. But is there a way of taking something where you're sort of taking a symbolic encoding that arose from distinctions made in the neural net and then using that to sort of make a higher level neural net, and whether that's a way to think about what happens in terms of the sort of the creation of concepts and so on. Because I think what we need ultimately is something where, I suppose, you know, one of the parts of computation that is not well, and universal computation, it's not really very well addressed, is the notion of encoding. That is, you know, when we have a universal computer, it's in principle possible to encode any program and decode the output from that program. We don't really talk a lot about the encoding and decoding. And maybe that's sort of the next thing that we need to think about in terms of having sort of these symbolic constructs for what happens at these different levels. But one of the questions would be, well, what would be the question you want to answer about this kind of hierarchy of concepts and so on? So in the case of universal computation, the question that turned out to be the interesting one to answer is, when we look at the space of all possible computations, what kind of a device do we need in order to execute these? And the fact that it turned out that we only needed this one kind of device, this universal computer, to execute these things. So a question about this kind of hierarchy of concepts or something, the question is, what's sort of the analogous question about that? What's the universalization question about that? What's the kind of general principle that we might imagine getting in that case? I mean, it's similar if you look at other principles, like whether it's natural selection or whether it's second law of thermodynamics. These are both places where there are many underlying details, some of which we can't readily detect, but then we can ask, what's the sort of universalized abstract principle that arises from those? And so that's the thing where I think what one would like to be able to answer is, how does that work in the context of this sort of hierarchy of concepts? What's the type of thing? Like, for example, to be able to say, it'll never get boring. That would be an interesting, you know, the it'll never get boring might be the same as something like the second law of thermodynamics. It won't be the same in details of mathematics and so on, but it might be the same kind of principle, that there will always be a hierarchy of new concepts that will always be concepts worth having. So what counts as a concept worth having? It might be something which, when you introduce that as a symbolic thing, it dramatically reduces the computational cost of going further. So it's an idea worth having. Just like in the design of Wolfram language, for example, you know, it's worth putting in a function where having that one function greatly reduces the lengths of programs, because people don't have to recapitulate that same lump of computational work. There's just a name for that. And so I think, you know, that's kind of the way of maybe of thinking about it is will there always be this kind of, will there be an inexorable sequence of concepts that that one can go through? Another question is, will life get harder or easier? That is, will it get to be the case that to make the next step, yeah, this is a, sort of an interesting version of this question, do you have to know more to make the next step? So, for example, if we ask, you know, how does modern education compare to ancient education? There were things we had to know in ancient education that we don't have to know anymore. You know, we don't have to know, you know, I missed out on the period of education where one had to know how to cut a feather to make a quill pen, right? Not necessary anymore. We've automated that out. And so there's a certain amount of stuff now that we have to learn in education, there's the question of whether that will be constant through time, because at every given stage one has sort of automated enough stuff that to go to the next stage one merely needs to learn kind of the top level of the what's been automated, or whether one will have to go back sort of to the beginning. Now obviously, if you make a model of education where you say, well, everybody should know right back to the beginning, they should know, you know, back to how to make the computer out of sand, so to speak, then you'll simply accumulate an exponential amount of baggage as you go forward. But the question is, if you actually just want to make that next step of progress, is the frontier always of constant size? It could be the case that as you evolve through the system, that the frontier, that to get to the next step will require a broader frontier than ever needed before. That is, to make the next breakthrough might require broader knowledge than has ever been needed before. It could be that back in the day, you only needed to know 10 things, so to speak, to make, you know, the next breakthrough. But in the future, you'll need to know a million things to make the next breakthrough. I don't know. That's the type of question one might start to imagine answering. Now, you know, these questions, as is usually the case in sort of a direction in science, right now it seems like a very mushy thing. What is a concept? You know, how would one start to talk about that? Just like when one started to talk about, you know, heat, for example, back 150 years ago, the idea of heat seemed kind of mushy. But then it became a precise thing, and one was able to make a science out of it. And so similarly, I think there's a notion of sort of concepts, interestingness, purpose, meaning. These are all kind of in a bucket together, and there's sort of one is at the threshold of being able to actually make a meaningful kind of meaningful set of meaningful abstract theory that involves these kinds of things. And it doesn't hurt that we're at the moment where, you know, artificial neural nets are reminding us a lot of lots of things that happen in brains. And the one example of where we have concept formation is in brains and in the course of knowledge and human history and so on. So, you know, I think this is a potential direction. Now things could happen. I mean, let's take the model that there is, that it's always the case that there's a sort of a frontier in the concept space, and you're always kind of, you can always get to the next level in concept space, and there's never an end. And at any given level, there's sort of an invariance, because like this question about how much do you have to know in education, there could be an invariance principle that at any given stage, you always have to know the same amount of stuff. So, you know, people say that, I don't know, 20,000 things you have to learn in K-12 education or something. I'm not sure if that's correct, but it could be the case that maybe only 10,000 of those are actually necessary in today's world, but who knows? But then it could be the case that at any moment in history, it's always going to be that same number, and that's what's going to be needed to take the next step. It could also be, another question is whether there are branches. In other words, right now in Western civilization, at least, we have essentially one branch of knowledge. We don't have the things that we make use of to get to the next stage in knowledge are pretty much a single corpus of knowledge. I mean, there are, you know, Eastern traditions and so on, which are somewhat different and somewhat a separate branch, but we pretty much have one branch that we make use of. And so that's another question, is whether in the, as you build up sort of this net of concepts and so on, whether in fact it is the case that that the economics of doing that are such that there will tend to always just be one branch, or whether in fact the economics of doing it are such that you can perfectly well have multiple branches. Again, a thing to understand. Whether one needs to have a model of essentially human civilization entrained with this model of the sort of formation of concepts, I don't know. But anyway, I see this as being kind of it's my latest version of kind of thinking about kind of the meta question of the future, is kind of in terms of this idea of what do we care about, what will we care about, what is there to care about, and what is the sort of sequence of things that one will invent to care about. So I think one thing that's sort of interesting about these things is that both some of these questions are ones that have sort of long been discussed in philosophy, whether it's some of these questions about ethics, things like this. Actually, this idea, what tends to happen, what I've observed happen, is that in the progress of science and technology, things that were philosophical become concrete. You know, all these things about reference of, how do you refer to things and identity and so on. All of these questions are just absolutely straight, you know, analogies to what happens with variables in computer programs and things like this. How do, you know, these paradoxes of reference, and is it this X or is it another X? Well, it's a lexically scoped X. Well, that has an analogy in ways that people talk about identity and philosophy and so on. But for us, it's a very concrete thing of it's a lexically scoped X, so to speak. And so it's interesting to see, and I don't know whether there's this notion of kind of the hierarchy of concepts. That's something which, in a sense, for the very reasons of its own construction, we've now reached the point where we start to talk about this hierarchy of concepts, because we've reached the point in this kind of development of concepts where that is the sort of level of abstraction that we're at. But I think, I don't know of any kind of philosophical analogs of that kind of question, but I sort of think, this is my, as I say, my latest realization about these kinds of things, that really is the core question that is the analog of the universal computation question. It's sort of the next meta level of that type of thing, is the yes, you can compute anything, but what do you care to compute type thing. I think that this reflects on so many different kinds of things. I mean, that there are, you know, whether it's the artificial intelligence is very closely related to the whole extraterrestrial intelligence business, because artificial intelligence is our first alien intelligence, basically. It's our first case where there is a thing which seems to have the attributes of intelligence, but it has no connection historically to us, except that in the case of AI, we kind of created it. But it has no necessary sort of evolutionary connection to us, which is the same thing that happens potentially with extraterrestrial intelligence, and that's the same kind of issue that we sort of confront there is, okay, so there are, you know, if there's extraterrestrial intelligence, what does that even mean in a world of the principle of computational equivalence, where the weather has a mind of its own, the pulsar magnetosphere has a mind of its own, it's generating some sequence of radio pulses that are coming out of the mind of the pulsar, so to speak. This question of whether the mind of the pulsar is an intelligent civilization that we should be very sort of excited about meeting, or whether it's just some physical process, is an interesting question. Because, as I say, you know, we are but physical processes doing our thing, and should some civilization or whatever we call it, some alien intelligence, be interested to meet us? I don't know. Depends whether we have, this then relates to, so in this kind of model of there are these interestingness things, there's sort of a question of, if you've got sort of a hierarchy of interestingness that's been built up by our civilization, a hierarchy of interestingness that's been built up by an alien civilization, what is the analogy? What's the sort of cross connection between these things? To what extent are those concept nets commensurate in any way? And so a way to put this would be, if the aliens had invented mathematics, would they have invented the same mathematics as ours? Would they have invented arithmetic? Would they have invented algebra? Things like this. My view of this has actually oscillated over time. I used to think that what we have in mathematics was pure historical accident, much as I used to think that what we have in biology is mostly pure historical accident. I'm not sure how true that really is. I think that this is the question of, in this kind of ocean of kind of computational complexity and irreducibility and so on, there are these various paths that one can follow through that, and maybe there aren't as many paths as one might imagine. And that's a question of which we, again, don't know the answer to. And it's a question of, there are many paths that could be followed, but there's a question of whether there are, you know, how many, from a pure combinatorial point of view, there are certainly many, many paths that can be followed. But when we add this constraint of kind of, you know, continual interestingness, so to speak, or continual purpose, meaning, whatever else we call it, it's less obvious how that will work. I think that another way to look at this is to think about, so when it comes to sort of the aliens, and the question is, what is their purpose? Is there even a definition of purpose where we can enmesh with their definition of purpose? When we look at the pulsar magnetosphere, does it have a purpose? It's very difficult that when we describe things in science and physics, whatever else, any process, we can say either the stone follows the trajectory it does because it follows a differential equation that says, from this moment, at this position, with this velocity, the next thing that will happen is the stone will do that. That's a kind of mechanistic explanation of how the stone moves. Or alternatively, a variational principle that says, the stone follows the trajectory of least action, which is essentially an explanation by purpose. It's saying, the purpose of the motion of the stone is to produce the trajectory of least action, as opposed to, the operation of the stone is to follow Newton's laws. It's a very confusing thing, whether the thing does what it does because it is achieving a purpose, or whether the thing does what it does because that is merely the mechanism by which it works. You can say the same thing about brains. You can say a brain is doing what it does because, the electrochemical signals in this neuron increase, and therefore the electrochemical signals in that neuron increase, and so on. It's a mechanistic explanation, very different from the explanation of it's doing what it's doing because it has this overarching purpose. I think maybe there's a way of teasing these things apart by thinking in terms of these lumps of purpose, these kinds of concepts, words, lemmas, whatever we want to call them, and maybe there's a way of understanding the extent to which essentially symbolic representations of things provide such a qualitative difference, maybe exponential, maybe something else, qualitative difference in the sort of rate of getting to somewhere in this sort of concept space, that it's worthwhile to identify them, and that we can kind of distinguish at some finally between this notion of, you know, things happen because of it is their mechanism to do that, and things happen because it is their purpose to do that. How that will relate to sort of purpose in the universe is not clear, because I think that that's a That's another interesting question, because you know, once we talk about purpose and we have the principle of computational equivalence and we have this notion of purpose for everything, we also have purpose for the universe, and it is in a sense no different from the purpose for other things. Anyway, I think I've somehow I'm realizing that sort of these questions of very abstract philosophy I think reflect very much on these sort of practical questions about the future. And I think one of the things that will be the case is that these things which we are right now talking about in terms of very abstract philosophical concepts, they will be the everyday back and forth of what does it mean to be human, how should we view kind of these things that emerge, which are kind of the uploaded digital human consciousnesses, what responsibility do they have, what responsibility do we have to them, and so on. All these things which today are kind of matters of abstract philosophy, at some moment in the future will become sort of the everyday everyday characteristics of what we do. I mean, it's certainly interesting to start imagining, you know, in this world of the uploaded human consciousness, the difference between the human and the AI, there really isn't any difference at all, because at that point, there's the sort of the brain, the uploaded brain and the artificial brain are really mixed together in the same substrate. And what it means to be kind of what it means to be a thought in a brain is, you know, there's no distinction between that and the thought in the sort of coexisting AI of that brain and so on. Anyway, lots of things, you know, to potentially look forward to, at least to look forward to figuring out how they're going to work. And I'm less depressed about the vision of the future of humanity as playing video games for the rest of it, disembodied souls playing video games for the rest of eternity. All right, I should stop there. Thanks.
You've been listening to part 2 of 3 in our series on the future of AI and civilization with Stephen Wolfram. Tune in for the next episode where Stephen answers questions from Wolfram Summer School students about computational democracy, AI and medical diagnosis, and the role of AI in the transition to an AI-based society, next time on the Stephen Wolfram Podcast. For more information on Stephen's blog posts, books, and live streams, visit stephenwolfram.com.